Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I am Jim Browdy, and she is Marjorie Egan. We're joined, as Marjorie said, this is our second round of interviews of men and women who would be governor of the Commonwealth. We're joined today by Don Berwick. Don is a physician, health policy expert. He ran the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services under Barack Obama. He's running for the Democratic nomination for governor. Don, good to see you again.
Good to see you. Thanks for having
me. Thank you for coming in. I'm dying to know, because you are running for governor. We just spent 20 minutes talking about former House Speaker Sal DeMasi. What do you think? Should he be brought, if Don Berwick were the governor of the Commonwealth, would you be pushing to bring him back to Devens or to commute his sentence?
Yes, I would.
You would?
Yeah.
I
compassion is part of my view of how public policy has to run. And there comes a time when you just look at a human being and say, let's be compassionate.
So would you bring him back, or would you let him out of jail?
Oh, I wouldn't let him out of jail.
Bring him back to Devens.
Yes. And, we should say formally governor wouldn't have the power, but the governor has a huge bully pulpit in these things.
Yes.
Should he or she choose to use it?
That's right. You could use your bully pulpit. That's correct. Second issue I'm dying to talk to you about, because you are a pediatrician.
I am.
The Department of Children and Families has been all over the place in the news. Not good news, actually, with a child being died that they could not, a five-year-old little boy dying that we think he's dying. He's disappeared in any case. I don't know where the child is. A lot of allegations of foster parents doing bad jobs, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. If you were governor, what do you think you might do to improve things at the Department of Children and Families?
Well, first, I mean, my initial reaction is emotional. My heart goes out to this family. And I mean, could you imagine being in that situation?
No.
I have four children,
I
and I just project myself into that and say, what tragedy. And it oughtn't to be. You know, my background, my whole career, 30 years, has been focused on management and executive leadership for excellence, how you get real reliability into a system. And I don't have access to the details of what's going on inside that agency, but there's a management failure here. And the way I lead is to organize around absolute excellence, getting it right every single time. And you have to work with the workforce, make sure they understand the mission, are connected to it. As a leader, tune into what some of the problems the workforce is facing. And I think there are probably serious resource issues here.
There
in this
are.
Agency.
Well, they claim there are anyway.
Yeah. So it's a rededication to support to the workforce, to insisting on absolute reliability and excellence every step of the way, and then fighting for the underlying issues of social justice and commitment to people of disadvantage, which underlies the probable underinvestment in this agency.
You must have seen, as a doctor, some kids come in to you that were poor kids or maybe troubled kids or involved in the system.
Yeah.
What kind of problems did you see that are linked to the Department of Children and Families or these kinds of issues?
Yeah, well, I saw a lot of it. I don't know the exact number, I should, but probably half of my population were kids on Medicaid, very stressed families. And I dealt with this for 19 or 20 years as a practicing doctor, fighting every day to get them the resources they need. It was a real problem. The problems I saw were largely issues of fragmentation. So you had a kid who needed services. Often they were mental health services. The underinvestment in mental health, substance abuse, behavioral services is very, very severe. And I would have to fight every day to get services to an adolescent or a young person who was really in emotional difficulty. But the other problem was fragmentation. You often had different agencies, social service, mental health, corrections, schools, in which there weren't the habits or the support systems to have them surround the kid and really create a unified, coherent plan to help the child and the family back into the mainstream.
But so many times the kids did not get the help they needed then.
A lot of people tried, but the fragmentation was a big problem. And yes, they didn't get the help they needed. I have tragic stories in my background of patients I fought for, and when they finally got really to an age where they left the young child support system, they got lost.
And it seems to me that one of the reasons why, as you and I know Marjorie has written about it, the services are underfunded, there's not a huge constituency for poor people. And one would hope that even if there aren't – people don't care about poor adults, they care about poor children. But I don't see a colossal amount of evidence that there's this broad movement that we have to worry about poor kids either. I hate to be crass about it. So what do you do to convert the public mind is that, you know, but for the grace of you-know-who – you could be that kid or that could be your kid. How do you change this, assuming you agree, how do you change the political dynamic, the mindset about them, those people?
I do agree. It's a national, not just a local issue, but we're in a country of increasing income disparity, people at the low end really losing out, and there are many more people there than there are at the upper end of the income ladder. And it's become conventional to talk about kind of well-being of the mainstream without being able to speak absolutely clearly about poverty and poverty alleviation and the need to be a society that is compassionate, organized around social justice and equality as a mainstream issue. And I think we need leaders who talk about that. In my candidacy, I'll tell you, I want to talk every single day about reaching out to people who really need help and getting them that help.
You know, when you walked in here, Marjorie asked you something ridiculous like, so you having fun? And your response was, yes. What is the fun part? I mean, what is the fun
ridiculous.
Part? I mean, if you were, I mean, this is no secret. The polls show Martha Coakley's got 50-some percent. She's got a ton of dough. You're in the currently in the second tier of candidates. What's the fun part when you have so far to go and you have so many mountains, to use a terribly overused expression, to climb? What's the fun part, Don Berger?
The fun's climbing mountains. Remember, I worked in Washington for a year and a half. I'm big, deep sigh of relief to be back here. This is a Commonwealth interested in the issues I'm interested in, which is that you can talk about social justice, you can talk about equality, you can talk about opportunity for everybody in this place, and it's a big relief. And I think maybe the most fun for me has been going around the state in the living rooms and libraries and homes and town committee meetings and speaking a progressive language about, aren't we a Commonwealth that has a vision about helping each other and being centered on issues of justice? And the heads nod. Everybody is there. And that's been very buoyant. And as far as the polls, I'll let other people read the polls. We're on a well-trodden path here as someone.
Okay,
not,
I'm not going to read the polls. I'm going to read the bottom line about how much it costs to go to college. You released an education plan. I know that one of the centerpieces is early education. I want to talk about later education. Marjorie and I have talked ad nauseum about this, what I consider to be disgraceful display in Washington when they're celebrating. They brought the interest rate down so it saved the average staffer loan recipients $6 a month, while the overall cost. What's your agenda for the lower and middle class family that can't afford even the $25,000, much less the $60,000, $25,000 of a public higher education? How do you get that? Which it seems to us is as critical as graduating from high school was, 20 or 30 years ago, meaning a college education. How do you bring the actual cost down as governor?
Well, you have to view it as an investment, not just a cost. In the statistics in the state, there are a lot of people looking for jobs that can't find them, but there are a lot of jobs looking for people that can't find them. And that's because the education system isn't lined up. And, Jim, that happens where you said it's in the higher education system, especially the community colleges and the state-supported higher education, which are gems in this state. If we really invested in these places as preparing people for the workforce of the 21st century, we have a solution in our hands. As for people who can't access that education, we need to help them access it. And part of my education platform is to make sure absolutely that if a young adult in Massachusetts wants to go to publicly supported higher education and cannot find other sources of support, we should provide the last dollar coverage to get them into higher education. That should just be part of our social policy.
So this would be like a free community college deal? Deval Patrick has talked about that.
Yes. My view is that people who can pay for it should do so.
Yep.
But kids who can't, we should look. We want to help people enter the economy. We want to create jobs, don't we? We want to have people be able to join the economy. Well, let's invest in people. That's the best investment you can ever make. So yeah, I want it to be a guarantee.
That's the voice of Don Berwick. He is a candidate for the Democratic nomination for governor, former head of the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services under Barack Obama.
You know, Jim and I have talked about this many times too. I know about education. We sort of disagree. I think that the teachers' unions have squashed a lot of reform.
She means. She doesn't necessarily mean you. We'll find
out.
Yeah,
Jim and I disagree about this, and that the quality of teaching has to improve in the lower grades for kids to be able to learn the basics. So how do you feel about some of these issues, merit pay for teachers or charter schools, which give more competition to the regular traditional public schools?
Well, let me first confess to some self-interest. My daughter is a teacher. She's in her second year of teaching in a middle school, absolutely loves it. My brother was a 40-year teacher, retired now. He lives in South Hadley. I guess I'm a teacher. My background is partly as a teacher. Teachers are not the problem. They're the solution. And of course there are some bad teachers, and we have to get them out of the system. That's true for any workforce. But it's 1 in 100, 1 in 200. It's not. We need to reinvest in the pride and joy of the teacher workforce. And that means giving them the supports they need. The unions will advocate for that. They're not always right. They're sometimes wrong. But I think they're on the side of success. They know that a successful school will be a good place to work. And when it happens that we invest in teachers, it works. I've been tracking, I haven't yet visited, but I've been tracking this really interesting story on Lowell, where the head of the teachers union there, Paul Georges, worked out a good understanding with the then superintendent, Chris Scott, and they agreed to work together, not teaching to the test, not ticking the box, not MCAS, 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 but let's get teachers to really grow in their skills and their ability to get advanced degrees. They worked, I think it was Fitchburg State that helped them. Well, they've turned around schools there. The Merkland School there was a level 4 school, a failing school. In 18 months, it was a level 1 school. And that didn't come from ticking boxes and carrots and sticks. It came from investing in the workforce.
But, you know, just as a view of the profession, every other profession, you can do well if you're the best at what you do. And you have to make a serious financial sacrifice to go into teaching because, you know, I mean, some of the teachers are paid well. In Boston, you make, I don't know, $80,000, $90,000 a year. But you're not going to make $150,000 a year. So why not, when you have these extraordinary teachers, pay them $150,000 a year, pay them $200,000 a year, and make that something people can aspire to by their skills in the classroom?
Well, it's a calling. I so admire people that are dedicating their lives to helping young people become the citizens they should be. And yes, I would argue for giving them more support. This is part of a larger picture of economic inequality in the nation and in the state, where there's so little relationship between these soaring amounts that the wealthy are making.
Right.
Begrudge that to them at the expense of investment in other things that our communities need, like schools. Working on equality, including income equality, I think is going to be – I think it ought to be the flagship issue of the next decade.
But you want teachers all to make the same. You wouldn't give the best teachers more money than the teachers that are struggling.
You'd be very, very careful with incentive pay. People come to work to be proud of what they do. And whenever you have that kind of, you know, reward the great and hurt the not so good, you create many more losers than winners. And I'd like to encourage teachers to do well and have everyone grow no matter where they're starting. That's my general view.
Okay.
I ran an organization for 19 years as a CEO. We never had merit pay in that organization. We always used team-based compensation and working with the workforce to get better at what they did. We invested in them instead of creating struggles and win and lose situations.
You know, Don Berwick, most of America, I would assume, never heard of the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services until the Affordable Care Act. You ran it for 16, 17, 18 months. The conventional wisdom on your campaign was that being there on the ground floor at the beginning of the Affordable Care Act, particularly in a state where it was wildly popular, less so now, was going to be a big asset. But you were also there at the time that the Affordable Care Act was beginning to be implemented. I've heard you say, in fact, you said it to me, but I think people will want to hear here, why are you not responsible as the guy who ran the center for some of the worst that we're seeing out of the original rollout of healthcare.gov and all the rest of the early days of the Affordable Care Act?
I'm proud of what I did there. We made a lot of wonderful steps forward with the early stages of the Affordable Care Act, covering kids under their parents' policies up to age 26, millions of kids, putting in prevention benefits. We began to close the donut hole of drug coverage for elders. We put insurance companies under new restrictions. We had a lot of really good work to do. The contractor that was hired apparently really screwed up. But they
were hired when you were there, weren't they?
Yeah, but the rules of leadership forbid the administrator from dealing in the contract process as you'd want. You wouldn't want a political appointee to come in and manipulate contracts. So I was kept at quite a distance from that. And since then, in December of 2011, I had to leave under the Constitution because I was a recess appointee. I became under a prohibition of any contact at all that was substantive with the Health and Human Services Department. So all I could do was read the papers like you for 2 full years for the first 22 months of the rollout. I wish I was there. I wish I knew what was going on, but I just don't.
You know, I should know the story. Did you know the president prior to taking this, or he just knew of you? What was your relationship with Barack Obama prior to this recess point?
No, I only met him after I was nominated in office. My contact was at that time Senator Tom Daschle. Senator Daschle, you remember, was going to be the Health and Human Services Secretary.
Majority leader for a while, yeah.
And he was taking some of the lead in health care reform design. And I had met with him a couple of times giving the new president advice on the direction to go. And I guess they thought the advice was worthy. And it was he who invited me.
So, Don Berwick, in any other state, the Affordable Care Act might be an albatross around your neck. Do you feel in Massachusetts it's going to hurt you or
no.
not? Because you are associated with it.
Yeah. No, I'm proud to be associated with a law that's trying to make healthcare a human right in this nation. This is a majestic step. It is very troubled in implementation. There are serious management flaws here, and I can see them at a distance. But look at the big picture here. We are the only Western democracy that has not yet made healthcare a human right. Now we're going to if we stick with it, and if these enemies that are trying to take this law down are shut down, we will. It's a big step.
Do you think it is going to prevail beyond Barack Obama's presidency?
Yeah, I would bet a lot it's going to prevail. The reason is if you ever tried to take it away now, there'd be public outrage because people would realize what they're losing. They would be losing the right to health insurance if they have pre-existing conditions. Their kids would now have coverage.
I love the kid one.
Oh my goodness! I mean, there is so much already good happening with this law that this attack because of what's bad, and it is bad. The rollout's bad. Is obscuring the real facts, which is this is a step forward for our nation, and I really don't think we'll ever go back.
Charlie Baker, who's running for governor on the Republican side, thinks we should get a waiver from Obamacare here in Massachusetts. What do you think the effect of that would be were that to happen?
A waiver? I'm for laboratories of democracy and the states being, you know, trying new things. As you know, I'm supporting a single payer direction for this state. I don't think that's the whole secret. We have to really do healthcare reform. It's delivery reform that's the real key. So care is more organized around your needs. But part of the reform, I think, could be a much simpler payment system. And that's what intrigues me about single payer. And we would need some federal waivers in order to get that. Luckily, in the Affordable Care Act, there are provisions in that act that allow states to take some steps forward. Massachusetts has always been a pioneer. We are the template for the Affordable Care Act. I think we could be a template for a much simpler and more user-friendly insurance system.
Yeah, speaking of single payer, though, what's the great Obama line that I'll butcher a little bit? Don't let the perfect be the enemy of the good. What appetite? I mean, I've spoken to a lot of people, liberals in the Democratic Party, who love you because of the single payer thing. My understanding, you're the only one of the five who is a single payer embracer. Is that not right? Is that
yes,
correct?
Yes, I believe that's the case.
But as a matter of practicality, when you look at the list of priorities for a Governor Berwick, it doesn't seem to me, looking at this legislature, that there's any appetite there for doing what you think should be done in terms of the delivery mechanism for health. You're making a face like you disagree with me. You think they could be convinced?
Well, first, my intention as a candidate is to say what I think, and I'm trying to really decide what I believe the best policies for this state and for its people would be, and that's why I believe this should be undertaken seriously. My face is about my surprise. I didn't know how it would play. I didn't make that decision as a political move.
No, I didn't mean that.
But when I go out, Jim, I mean, I'm in these living rooms and libraries, and I'll tell you, the heads are nodding. I think people are kind of fed up with the complexity and the opacity and the feeling they don't understand what's going on. And I think they sense that there are ways to change which will be more accountable, more transparent. And in the end, more directed at health, which is where we need to go. So, Jim, I'm sensing resonance here. That's part of the fun.
I'm not laughing at you, by the way. The reason I'm laughing, when you use the word opaque, Marjorie and I are trying to figure out how to get a fishing license to go to New Hampshire ice fishing on Sunday, and I can't figure it out. And you can imagine people trying to sign up for healthcare. Hey, we're talking to Don Berwick, who is a Democratic candidate for the Democratic nomination for governor of Massachusetts. Can we talk about some of the ballot issues that are obviously high profile? Mm-hmm. You have said, I believe, that if the Supreme Judicial Court approves putting the casino repeal question on the ballot, I am right that you said you'd vote for repeal. Is that correct?
Hey, I'm against the casinos and for the repeal.
Why?
I think casinos are a bad deal for the state. There's evidence here from other states' experience. They hurt small businesses in their communities. DUIs go up and minor infractions go up. The communities become less safe. They are bringing a new mental health burden into the state. Absolutely. Here we are struggling with health care costs with an under-supported mental health system, and here we're going to add gambling addiction to our needs. And I think the revenue estimates, they're inflated. We know there's cannibalization, so some of the casino revenue will come out of the lottery, and that's going to offset, I think, at least a third, maybe more. I just think it's the costs so far outweigh the benefits here. And you've heard our governor and our speaker say that they wouldn't want it in their town. Well, it's not happening in our state.
How do you feel about marijuana as a physician? We now have medical marijuana is legalized here. There's a great expectation that it's going to be legalization on the ballot, go the whole way. What do you think about that?
Well, at first, as a physician, the medical use of marijuana, which we now have, I think it's absolutely right. I've had patients. I've seen people whose nausea or pain just can't be controlled any other way. I would not deny them the relief that they can get from this. I think decriminalization, which we've done now, is a very important move. In fact, we need to think further about that. Our prisons are full of people who have minor infractions or mental health problems and not getting the right kind of care. For full legalization, I'm actually a little more cautious about this. I don't know what the total effect would be. I am a physician. I'm worried about the public health implications. And now we have experiments going on. Colorado's going to experiment for us. Why don't we wait? Give me 24 months. Let's let it play out, see what begins to happen. And then, sure, I'd be happy to consider it at that point.
All the candidates were asked the other day, I can't remember where the forum for it was, about the recommendation of the Attorney General Holder that the federal government would seek the death penalty against Tsarnaev, the younger Tsarnaev. I believe all five of the candidates for governor of the Democratic side said they thought it was a bad idea. Why is it a bad idea?
Look, I have no sympathy for the crime. Let's get that straight. But I think the death penalty – well, the Boston Bar Association said the death penalty has no place in American jurisprudence. It just doesn't. It is a form of punishment that is often unfairly distributed according to ethnic and wealth levels. It doesn't – it's not an effective deterrent. We know that empirically. And you know what? We're flawed. It sometimes is wrong and it's irreversible. So I don't think it's the right way to be dealing with a correction system.
You know, I believe, unless I'm mistaken, you are supporting one of Jim Browdy's pet proposals. Aren't you a graduated
that?
Income tax
yes.
Guy?
Well,
Did you know who led the previous stalwart
effort? I don't brag about it. We've lost by a narrow 71-29 margin.
Explain to people what that is and why you're for it, Don Berwick.
It's a tough fight. First, we need revenue to work within the state. There are other sources. Healthcare reform, if we do that properly, we'll bring back dollars that we can reinvest. We need to get rid of the tax exemptions and loopholes that are just taking. There are so many of them. I'll keep the ones that add jobs and the ones that support the safety net. But not others. We need to hit the reset button on that. But we'll come down to the point where we're going to need some revenues. And I'm for fair taxation. And fair taxation to me means people at the low end of the income spectrum pay lower rates and people at the higher end pay higher rates. And that is a fight I'm willing to engage. Again, I think it's just. I think it's right. And it's the kind of commonwealth I think we want to have, and I'll take that on.
One of my opponents would probably say, Don Berwick, what do you not understand about no? what they used to say to me is the public has rejected this overwhelmingly 4 times out of 4, and what they would say now is the public has rejected it 5 times out of 5. I was the unfortunate recipient of the 5th no, along with the other supporters.
You did a great job, though, Jim.
I mean, have the people not spoken on a progressive income tax in Massachusetts?
I'm a believer that change is always possible. We're an evolving society. We learn as we go. I think the levels of income inequality that we're now living with in the country have grown and grown and grown. I think there's an extraordinary level of aggravation with this. People in the top 1% of income in this country have had almost a 300% raise in their income since the 1970s. At the bottom 20% is an 18% increase, and at the bottom, it's a decrease. Enough. It's time to engage in public policies that allow us to be a more equitable society. And to me, it's right. Those with great wealth, I don't begrudge them that, but let them contribute more because they can.
Are you going to be on the ballot? The caucuses started a couple of days ago. They run through, I think it's early March. For those who don't know, it's not that arcane. The system requires that any candidate get 15% of a vote of 15% of the delegates of the convention, whatever it is, sometime in the summer. There are 5 of you. What's the realistic expectation that Don Berwick, who most people in the state hadn't heard of, obviously your profile has risen pretty dramatically in the last few months, what's the likelihood that you're one of the 15 percenters?
I think I'll be there.
Why?
Because we're running a campaign right. I'm using everything I know about management and executive leadership in the campaign the way I would as governor. I want to lead for excellence and lead for delivery, lead for results. And there, it's hard. You have to organize a field staff. You have to be all over the state. But we have a very well-organized field operation because we care about it. So and the response has been there. And as I articulate my agenda, such as you've explored here, single payer, casino, the poverty alleviation, and really the concept of a just and equitable society, a compassionate society, is fundamental. I think that message holds, and I expect to be on that ballot.
People like pediatricians too, Jim. They may not like other kinds of physicians, but pediatricians are right up there.
What's your website before you go, Don Berwick, so people can check out?
BerwickForGovernor.com.
Simple enough.
Thank you very much for coming in to be with us today. Don Berwick is a physician, a pediatrician, and a health policy expert who ran the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services under President Obama. He is running for governor on the Democratic ticket.